This is listener-supported public radio. You are tuned to KBBI, AM 890, Homer. It's membership drive day, but it is also time for Kachemak Science, dedicated to local science and local scientists, with the Kachemak Bay Birders, who are putting out their monthly Bird of the Month column. While you're listening, birders and people who love birds, call 235-7721 and make your donation to your public radio station. But let's start this off with bird rhythms and then very special live presentation of data. I caught their act at the McNeil Canyon Elementary Science Fair. So Hudson and Bubba are in the studio, but first...
Welcome to Bird Rhythms, brought to you by Kachemak Bay Birders. Sandhill cranes announce spring has arrived with their resonant trumpeting in the sky and loud unison calls on the ground. The arrival of Homer's most charismatic and iconic bird, the lesser sandhill crane, happens on average April 12th. Lesser sandhill cranes grace our local hayfields, estuaries, marshes, and uplands. The smallest of three crane subspecies, they are still very large birds. Gray birds, standing roughly 3 to 3.5 feet tall and weighing about 6 to 7 pounds with a wingspan of about 6 feet. Their sharp, 4-inch-long dagger-like beak makes it easy for them to find plenty of worms, insects, frogs, fish, ducklings, voles, berries, roots, tubers, and other seeds and grains. Adults are mostly gray, with red on the top of the head, black legs and beak, and yellow eyes. Now, three really cool things about sandhill cranes. One, they are very ancient birds whose fossil records date back 10 million years. Two, cranes use tools, grass, and twigs to paint themselves with iron-laden mud for camouflage when nesting. And three, because of their long, looped trachea, much like a trombone, which makes their throats a big amplifier, their calls can be heard about 2.5 miles away. Nesting cranes can be easily seen along the Beluga Slough Boardwalk below the Islands and Ocean Visitor Center. Take a walk down to Bishop's Beach. You just might see a crane family with rusty-colored colts, which is what they call the chicks. If you see nesting cranes, please make a report to Crane Watch by calling 235-6262 or email reports@cranewatch.org. My name is Nina Faust, co-founder of Kachemak Crane Watch here in Homer. Visit our website at www.cranewatch.org and check out some of our sandhill crane videos. Now, here's a tip on how to tell a male and female crane apart. Look closely at the two sandhill cranes you see, usually a mated pair standing together, making this sound, a unison call. The one with the beak straight up is a male, and the one at 45 degrees is a female. Both lesser sandhill cranes, the bird of the month. My name is Nina Faust, co-founder of Kachemak Crane Watch here in Homer.
Bird Rhythms is brought to you by the Kachemak Bay Birders. We have meetings and birding trips once a month, plus many more activities for our 2018 Year of the Bird. Check out the upcoming events and complete information about our Bird of the Month on our website, KachemakBayBirders.org. All events are free and open to the public. This is Gary Lyon for Kachemak Bay Birders. And remember, every day is a great day to bird.
You can hear from the whales in the background that it's time for more Kachemak Science. Live in the studio, Hudson Lowboy. Hello, Hudson.
Hi.
Bubba Chouette Iwamura. Gotcha. Tell me a little bit about yourselves. Where do you go to school?
So I'm Hudson Lowboy, and I go to McNeil Canyon Elementary, and I've been going there since third grade.
I'm Baba, and I've been going to McNeil for around 3 weeks now. I moved from Colorado.
Oh, you're so new.
Yeah.
Well, welcome. Thanks for coming to Homer.
Yeah. I've been coming here for a while, but I've never tried the winter, so it's really fun.
What'd you think?
I loved it.
Great. So I met you guys at the McNeil Canyon Elementary Science Fair. Also present in the studio is Phil Barber, a local scientist who acts as a judge at the science fair. And Phil, can you tell people what you thought when you came upon this poster on dissolved oxygen?
Good morning. So I was looking around, just trying to get a feel for what projects were available, what I'd be looking at, what I'd be judging, and came around a corner and got stopped in my tracks by this poster about dissolved oxygen in macroinvertebrates, and it stopped me because that is exactly what I got my graduate degree on. So I was incredibly interested to speak to the young students who did the same research that I did, just in across the country. I did mine in New York, and so I was interested to see speak to them about how they did it, what they did, and what their findings were.
So Hudson and Bubba, are you guys ready to make your presentation for the audience?
Yeah.
Well, go for it. I'll just turn it over to you.
Okay, so our presentation was on dissolved oxygen and macroinvertebrates and how they correlated. We found that our hypothesis said we think that if there's a little dissolved oxygen, there might be higher DO levels for macroinvertebrates. So our graph showed we were only right in one spot, and that one spot was Beluga Lake. Beluga Lake is near the stoplights. We tested Homer Spit and Beaver Creek. Homer Spit, we had 4 parts per million for DO and about 4 macroinvertebrates. Now, Beaver Creek had the highest amount of DO. We think this because of...
Because the stream is flowing a lot right now, because it's breakup season, the ice is melting, and there's a lot more water in the water.
A little bit more of a brief description. Because the creek is moving and there's wind up there, the oxygen is pushed into the creek, causing more DO in the creek, which is just oxygen in the creek, which is dissolved oxygen. So we found because Beaver Creek is moving, we have a ton of DO in there and a moderate amount of macroinvertebrates. Our macroinvertebrate count was 24. So the highest count of macroinvertebrates that we found was at Beluga Lake, which was 37. And the DO there was 3. So we found an average about 1/3 of your DO is how many macroinvertebrates you're going to get. So then we're looking at our 3 common macroinvertebrates in Alaska. The 3 common macroinvertebrates are
mayfly, stonefly, and caddisfly. They are most common in Homer because they just thrive the best here.
The mayfly wiggles back and forth to move in the water. Most mayflies have 2 tails, tails being a different subject. The stonefly travels in straight lines when moving and has a similar neck compared to a mayfly. The caddisfly has a shell or carcass that it makes from leaves, rocks, sticks, anything it can find, and they usually stay on rocks on the bottom of a lake or creek. They eat leaves, or even some macroinvertebrates eat meat from the water, which is really cool. Our controlled variables, we were looking at the DO kit, the area of water we were testing. We never changed the area of water. We always went to the same spot at the same site. So we had a very consistent amount of data from that exact same spot. Testing times, we tried to do our testing from about 10 to noon so we could get the same time of day. So our conclusion was,
our hypothesis about less DO in the water, it's true in a couple spots, as Hudson said, and not true in a couple. There is a little DO in the water. The Homer spit because it was more windy, we thought.
When there's wind, we get more DO. So Homer spit, we thought there was less DO because of the salt water. The salt water holds less DO than fresh water, and it was really cold. So cold water does hold DO better than warm water, but it was cold enough that it doesn't hold water enough. So even though there was wind, it wasn't really going into the water like it would if it was fresh water. So the conclusion said there's a little DO at the Homer spit because we think of it's a colder place, it's salt water, and there's less turbulence there. There is currents, and you might say there's a lot of wind, but because it's a colder surface, the wind doesn't affect it more. At Beluga Lake, there's more DO because the wind can go through the water, kind of. That's how DO is created there, so that's how we got a pretty big high count there. Then we were looking at how do we study macroinvertebrates. So we figured out we needed a D-net for studying macroinvertebrates. You put it on the bottom and you just move it along the bottom, and whatever you get in the net, you divide up and see what macroinvertebrates you got. For testing DO, we used a normal DO kit, which was many, many steps of testing and testing and testing. And that came up to be, here's all the DO for each site. Beluga Lake was 3 parts per million. Homer Spit was 4 parts per million. Beaver Creek was 9 parts per million. Beaver Creek had the most because it was a moving stream, as we explained. Now, Beluga Lake had 37 macroinvertebrates. That's way more than any of the other sites. Homer Spit only had 4, and Beaver Creek had 24.
So,
any questions, Phil?
Yeah, well, we spoke a little bit about this on Wednesday when I first met you guys. And what really impressed me was the way you stuck to the scientific method. You laid out your hypothesis, you described your procedure, you set up a controlled variable, you were testing for just dissolved oxygen, and then your conclusion, you said there was some correlation, but in other places there weren't. And I was just wondering, if DO isn't the driver in all cases, have you guys maybe thought about what else might be a driver out there? What else would you like to test for to explain differences in the macroinvertebrate community?
We did, I explained this, but last year, I did the exact same test. So I have 2 graphs. I can compare data from 2 years of research on the exact same 3 sites. Now, we never decided to test for pH, which is acidity level in the water. I really think we should have tested for pH because macroinvertebrates have a shell that can be dissolved by pH because it has calcium in it. That shell, if there's a lot of acidity in the water, can be dissolved by more acidity in the water. So I think we really should have tested for pH or looked at it more, even used Globe or another site that has tested in those spots for pH, just to give us a better idea of what's actually going on in the water.
Yeah, that's very interesting. So you focus on the DO, and you've obviously figured that there are other factors available. Now, if someone were to ask you, okay, we're talking about macroinvertebrates, these aquatic insects in the water, dissolved oxygen, why should I care about it? What would you say to someone who asked you that? Why is this important?
What's really important about these animals is it's a really big indicator for pollution in our water. See, at Beluga Lake, wherever we go there, we see a lot of pollution. From McDonald's, we see cups, plates, forks, and we always pick those up. But dissolved oxygen, macroinvertebrates need dissolved oxygen. When there's trash, plant matter, dead things, whatever, really. Pollution, really. It takes a lot of DO just to dissolve a little bit of that. One plastic bottle can take all the DO out of a certain area and ruin the ecosystem, ruining the... And fish need DO. For those fishermen out there who think, oh, this doesn't affect me. Well, fish really need DO to live because that's how they breathe, underwater. It's a really big indicator how much pollution is in one spot. Homer spit was a little bit different of an exception because it was salt water. Salt water doesn't hold DO as well as fresh water, but still, Beaver Creek had the highest amount of DO. That's not only because of the stream moving and a lot of wind up there, it's because it has very, very little human impact. There is one culvert on it, and that for one road to cross. The rest of it is just open stream down to the Inca River system. There is no human interaction unless we're testing there, but otherwise, we have never seen trash, pollution in it. So that's why it keeps that good, consistent, high amount of DO. Last year when I tested there, the same thing happened. It stayed at a consistent DO because there's no pollution. Beluga Lake, it really changes. When you test in the summer, it really goes up and it really goes down because there's people going there on float planes and it just really moves around. And if it was just even if it was just a lake with a little bit of flow, like a creek going out of it, you'd have a very consistent amount of DO and no human impact. So if I went to a lake in the middle of nowhere on a float plane and I'd go there every week and I would test, most likely because there's no human impact, the DO would stay about the same. But you wouldn't want to test near the float plane because that causing DO to be pushed into the water, but otherwise, it would stay the same. It really shows what impacts our waters.
One other follow-up question is, you've mentioned you did this last year, you've done it again this year, and some people might say, if you're trying to learn something new, why don't you test something new? Why don't you keep moving along? Okay, you saw DO last year, why focus on it again? What would you say to something like that?
Well, I would say, if you don't test it consistently, you have no idea what's going on. If I just do DO 1 year and then I move to something else, I can't compare data. I can't say, oh man, we have to do something. The DO is dropping or the pollution is getting higher.
Yeah, you scientists call that establishing baseline
yeah.
data, right?
So our baseline right now is macroinvertebrates and dissolved oxygen. We're really just looking at that to see what's going on. And it is a really big indicator of what is going on in our waters in Alaska. If anyone asked that question, what was the exact question?
Just why repeat the same thing over and over?
Because if you see a big decline, like next year if I do this again, I test, and I see Beluga Lake, because right now there's 37 macroinvertebrates in a 10-foot square area for one net down. That's amazing. That means that it's really thriving. But if I go back next year and I see there's only 10 in a 10-foot square area for one net down, that's not good. That means pollution has gone up and water quality has gone down. And then I want to start testing for DO, macroinvertebrates, and pH to see if acidity is doing anything to do with that. Because if it is, then you can say, well, maybe we need to make a fence around Blue Lake in some spots where McDonald's is, because that's where most of the pollution's coming in, just human impact there.
Now that you've established some baseline data, do you plan on continuing this study?
Yes, it'd be really interesting to see over a space of many years what the data comes up to be. And, Baba, do you have any thoughts on this?
Well, I'd love to, follow up on it next year and maybe even do 3 graphs on pH, too. Yeah, that'd be really
cool. So to add to the study now.
Yeah, I would say it would be really awesome to see the different, what correlates with everything. And then after you make that, you can even go to more acidity level is pH, but you can go to what is the fish population? What are we looking at for fish? Not macroinvertebrates, things that have spines. So we can see what's going on, what's in there. And then maybe do pollution studies. How many pounds of pollution or pounds of trash do we find in a 10-foot square area in near the docks at Blue Lake, near McDonald's? Well, I'd guess around 5 or 6 cups, different things, and you'd slowly get to see what's going on in all those waters, and you can compare the data, which is very valuable to everybody on many programs. We've put our data up on GLOBE, which is an international program of data that other scientists have found, and you put it up there, and everyone looks at it, and people can make conclusions from that hypothesis. It's pretty cool.
And does it also help you solicit peer review on
yes.
GLOBE? Have you gotten any response?
Yes, we have. We've seen people, I think we've had about 10 views on our data, just our data from many different places around the world, because the data is very, very, very consistent in most places. But it's a little bit warmer there, so it all changes. I'll talk a little bit about the project we did last year, the same project, but it was a little bit different. It was for GLOBE, and that means the people I did it with last year, we did it, and then we got to go to South Dakota to present it on a symposium. We got about the same data as we did this year, and we compared the data from South Dakota, what they got, and it was crazy different. More macroinvertebrates, but less DO, because hot water does not hold DO as well as cold water or mutually warm water. So if you're getting the water more hot or hotter, it really changes what's going on in the ecosystem.
So as our water warms, which it is,
we are going to see a decline in fish because the DO is going away, so that it's hard for them to breathe and hard for them to survive, and probably an incline in macroinvertebrates.
So I saw you taking a note over there. You got any notes for me? I also wanted to say to Hudson and to Bubba, we want to wrap up in the next 2 minutes. If there's anything you feel like has been left out
or that still needs to be said. Oh, you can talk or not. It's I really appreciate the work that both of you have done. And thanks for being here, Phil.
Yeah, no, I just want to say how much everyone at the McNeil Science Fair, it was fantastic. It was my first year out there. It was great to see the youth from first grade up to sixth grade really investigating the world around them. And what I would like to stress is just that this is, you know, it's a simple question, and it's just pushed forward by the desire to learn. These students just wanted to know what was going on with this dissolved oxygen and the macroinvertebrates, and so they did it. It doesn't take a degree to do this. It doesn't take pressure. If you want to ask a question and find the answer, that's all science is. And, you know, anyone out there can do it, and these two gentlemen have an excellent example of citizen science and asking a question and answering it for themselves.
And is there anything you guys feel like you need to sum up? Go for it.
Not really from the board, but as you were just saying, the kits we used were not expensive, fancy gear. It was very just a net and a deo kit, which you can get on Amazon or something like that. And it's just very simple to do science in your own town or your own city.
I wonder if even those kits are available locally. I would imagine there are some science organizations locally where you might be able to get.
I've seen other science locations like let other people kind of use your gear as long as they go through a little, like, you know, how to use it, how not to break it. And then just to wrap up, we talked a lot about dissolved oxygen. Bubba, do you want to explain what dissolved oxygen is?
If you would, Bubba.
Okay. If you want to?
So dissolved oxygen is, you can't really tell how much there is by just looking at the water. But if the water's like full of debris, that usually indicates there's no or little DO in that location. If the water is clean, the levels are pretty good and high. Here you go, Hud.
Okay, so what I was just talking about a little while ago is how DO is affected by pollution. So you can't just look at the water and say, oh, it's 4 parts per million. But you can say, you know what, it's probably going to be less DO because we just saw there's a ton of pollution or there's a ton of plants growing. Plants take dissolved oxygen. They don't take oxygen if they're underwater. They take dissolved oxygen, which is just what everything else is. Anything underwater pretty much uses dissolved oxygen. A few fish, people might say, argue that fish that, like flying fish, they breathe oxygen, but they still have to breathe underwater when they're swimming. So it really just affects everything there.
Well, Hudson Lowboy and Bubba Shewitt Iwamura, thank you so much for being here and presenting your data live on dissolved oxygen and macroinvertebrates. Phil Barber, thanks for being here to help lead us through it.
You're welcome.
And here come the whales. We have a few experts coming in next. Kyra Wagner and Rachel Lord will be coming in to tell anyone who enjoyed this presentation and would like to promote citizen science and the Catchamac Science Show where a person might pledge some money to keep this sort of thing going. Hudson and Bubba, thank you so much for being here. And Phil, thanks a lot. Thank you, whales. Kyra Wagner and Rachel Lord are in the studio, and they're going to tell you how a person might become a member or just pledge a little money to KBBI, as it is our membership drive day. Take it away.
Good morning, everyone, and feel free to give a call, 235-7721. Make sure that you pledge a little bit of support to the KBBI science system we've got going on here.
Catchamac Science, I've been wanting to do this for 2 years now. This is our second show, and so it's a little different. It's not so produced as the last one because we're coming in and out of it. Right. But later in the show, you'll hear from city planner Julie Engelbretson on the health of the Bridge Creek watershed. And then also you'll hear from Sue Mauger talking part one of our conversation about her trip to Antarctica.
Oh, sweet.
So.
Yeah, see, that's the kind of thing that is so important to share in our community, is all of those connections. I mean, this town has got more scientific data compiled about our bay and about everything from macroinvertebrates in our streams.
I heard you have a connection to that stream.
Oh, it just so happens that working with Rachel, I was a citizen scientist volunteer. My husband and I did studies on Beaver Creek for years, and macroinvertebrates were my favorite thing, watching all those little critters come out of the water.
Yeah, and you know, I moved to Homer in 2008, in early 2008, and started working for Cook Inlet Keeper that fall. I did oversee the citizen monitoring program, so it was really fun to hear those kids talk about their dissolved oxygen monitoring. And you know, over the years, Inlet Keeper trained over 300 people in the Homer area to do that kind of thing on streams around the Lower Peninsula, which is really awesome. We really have always relied heavily on KBBI for getting the word out, for sharing with folks important information.
Also, the other thing I wanted to ask you, Rachel, is I think I heard from Cook Inlet Keeper that there is a wrangling of that data now that's happening.
Yes.
Can you update us?
I'm working on it. Sue, if you're listening, I'm sorry, I'm working on it. We have, over the many years that citizen monitoring program started in 1996 and really was a template for monitoring programs around the state, and we worked through 2014 collecting full baseline water quality data sets on kind of all the priority streams in our area. So we have about half of those reports are completely done for the watersheds. We have 16 full reports that will come out, and they are in the works. The other day I was at the Kachemak Board of Realtors meeting at Bidarka. And it was their annual meeting. It was great. It was a pretty full room of all sorts of realtors from the Lower Peninsula. And in addition to the presentation that I was giving, we had the Kachemak Bay Research Reserve was there. And Cooey Walker and a team from the reserve was there talking to the realtors about tools that they're developing to help share the story of salmon on the landscape, and how when you're selling property, when you're buying property, when you're thinking about developing property, different ways that you can have information to know how the watersheds are connected, not just by the streams that you kind of can see, but through the groundwater and the alders and things like that.
So that's a perfect segue to our next segment here on Kachemak Science, because from last month's science conference, city planner Julie Engelbretson is now going to hold forth for you all on the health of the Bridge Creek watershed and address that very issue about your property.
I want to make sure that everybody's very well hydrated, so if you have a little glass of water, just, you know, pause.
There's Donna Adderhold.
That's good. This is Homer water. It is award-winning water. I want you to know this. And it all comes from the Bridge Creek Reservoir. Julie Engelbretson with the City of Homer Planning Department is going to talk to us about the Bridge Creek Reservoir.
Everybody can hear me okay? Excellent. My name is Julie Engelbretson. I'm the Deputy City Planner for the City of Homer and the Planning Department, and today we're going to talk about the Bridge Creek Reservoir and land use regulation. And as we get going here, I want to explain a term. An impervious surface is the concept that when water falls from the sky, it will absorb into the ground and do whatever it does naturally, find its way to a lake or a stream or be available in an aquifer to be pumped out for someone. If something is impervious, when the water falls from the sky and hits that surface, it runs off and goes somewhere else and doesn't end up in the ground it would happen in a natural state. So the City of Homer built a dam in 1976 across the Bridge Creek area. And at that time, it was completely, the whole reservoir, which is about 36 acres, and then the watershed, it's bounded by Crossman Ridge on the north and Skyline Drive on the south. The watershed was completely outside of city limits, and so the city was able to work with the borough to get extraterritorial zoning control in 1999. And it took a couple years. We had an annexation in that time frame, but we finally adopted regulations in 2003. So it took us years to have public meetings and talk about how to regulate a watershed. And this is in the days before Google, so there wasn't a lot of information online, and maybe you had to pay for content. And it's something for scientists to think about in the future. How will non-scientists stumble on your research? If I don't have a paid subscription to something, what does that look like? The study that was provided to the city in some shape or form was identification of linear and threshold responses in streams along a gradient of urbanization in Anchorage, Alaska. And this is sort of an abstract part that I pulled out. But basically, in that time frame, it was thought that 10% impervious surface, here's our pavement, if you had 10% impervious surface in your watershed, that's going to impact your water quality. And this study said, no, it's really much lower. It's 4.5% to 5.8% matters. Our regulations also talk about stream buffers and land uses and even animal units. So someone in my position, I don't just have to know about impervious surfaces. I got to learn about, you know, these cute little critters and people who say, hey, I want to have a farm in the watershed. Can I have horses and pigs and cows? Yes, it depends. Or what if I want a gravel walkway or a brick walkway? Well, that's an impervious surface too. And our regulations dictate how much impervious surface you can have on your property. This covers decks, tool sheds, greenhouses. This is a shot of the watershed. There's a piece of a for sale sign here. There's some property for sale in the watershed. The city has purchased quite a bit of property over time. We've spent probably $600,000 over the last 15 years acquiring property. It's a desirable place to be. There's natural gas in part of it. It's good building ground for Homer and relatively affordable. We recently partnered with the Kachemak Heritage Land Trust to preserve another 280 acres through a conservation easement. Here's an example of a house that was built before the watershed regulations. The house is probably too big for this size lot. You know, if they're limited to the 4.2% impervious surface, it's got a long driveway and it has a really large lawn area. We don't, as I was preparing this presentation, it dawned on me that we're seeing more properties with big lawns, and you can have a certain amount of lawn, a nice big lawn in this area, but I don't think we envision that people would have a half acre of lawn. That typically hasn't been real common in our community, but it's becoming more common. This is another house that's on the market. It about fits in the watershed regulations. It was built before the regulations. You know, who doesn't want this, right? But it's maybe not the best thing for our water quality. And as a land use planner, this is a common question, but can I have chickens? Well, yes, you can have chickens, but the chicken shed is the problem because it also is an impervious surface. And if you're already using all of your allowance, then that comes down to the kids' play structure on the tool shed and the greenhouse as you are already over. And that's a hard thing for people to understand. They care about water, and they want to do the right thing, but it's really hard to tell someone, no, you can't build your, you know, 10 square feet of impervious surface because you're already over it. So how's all this working? The city of Homer was the recipient of the Alaska Rural Water Association's 2017 Source Water System of the Year Award in recognition of this program that the zoning regulations. And the state of Alaska also recognizes that because the city has enforceable zoning regulations, that is an asset as far as protecting our drinking water source, because it's a surface water source and it's very vulnerable to pollution and things that might happen as far as land use around the watershed. So to wrap it up, what science would help? There isn't necessarily research that would help. It's more scientists showing up or providing written comments at public meetings. Speaking to your audience and being approachable. I think our scientific community does a great job at that, but realize sometimes you are the good kid at the science class, and your audience might be a little bit intimidated by that because they probably are not. Making presentations on a regular basis to community groups. Maybe you give the same presentation every 3 years to the Planning Commission because there's turnover and there's new people at the table there. I guess that tells me I'm over. I'm going to go back. Serving on boards and commissions, and also outreach such as newsletters and websites are helpful. I get some of those things in my job, and it's sort of nice to know what's going on with salmon, even though my work doesn't directly relate to that. So, there's my presentation.
Those whales, they're my favorite guests. Kyra Wagner and Rachel Lord are in the studio.
And I wanted to say, you know, we just heard from Julie Ingebretson from the city.
There is one more segment for Kachemak Science. It is Sue Mauger, who I'm sure you know, who has returned from a trip. She went to Antarctica with a group of women scientists. And this is part one of the conversation that we had. You're going to hear much more of it on next month's Kachemak Science. But here is Sue Mauger.
And I am the science director at Cook and the Keeper. And I have been studying the salmon streams of the Cook Inlet region for about 18 years.
Through Cook and Let Keeper for all 18 years?
Yep. The first job that I got when I came to Alaska was as the science director. Actually, at that point, I was just a stream ecologist, and I was picking up on a project that was going on looking at the water quality of the streams locally and how the bark beetle infestation had changed the landscape and what that might mean for our salmon streams. So a project responding to community concerns about a changing landscape symptom, and we did that project for about 5 years, and that's where we really discovered that we were seeing some impacts from our changing climate already in our streams, and that the bark beetle infestation was really a product of that, that those warm summers that we were starting to really enjoy was why the beetles were able to reproduce so much faster and that we had that huge outbreak. So we were also seeing that warm summer pattern in the stream temperatures. It was a very organic way to stumble across what was happening in our landscape. And it was the people asking for that kind of research that really helped us find that story.
And you spent February and March of 2018 in Antarctica?
I did.
How did that start? Where did you get the idea that you wanted to go, and what was the process to getting there?
February of 2017, I saw a post on Facebook of the bow of a ship moving through ice, and there were about 20 women standing at the front of the ship, and it said, "Women scientists head to Antarctica." That caught my attention for many reasons. Who doesn't want to go?
Woman, scientist, Antarctica, check, check, check.
What's wrong with any of that? It's perfect. So I clicked on the link, and that took me to the information about Homeward Bound, which is this global leadership program for women in science. And the picture that I saw was from the first team of 80 women who went down to Antarctica. The link was advertising the second team and the application process for the second team. There was a 1 month that application was open. So I said, all right, I'm going to follow through and write the application. It was actually fairly simple, very specific questions about what I wanted to do to create a change in the world. And how did that relate to my science? And how did that relate to me as a woman? One of the fun parts of the application is they required you to do a 2-minute video, which is challenging for people to get in front of a camera for 2 minutes. But I went down to the Anchor River. Fortunately, there were moose browsing on all of the willows, and it was, you know, the
great ambience.
It was, yeah, it really had a real Alaska feel to it, and I felt like I was showing that I could handle snow and ice and everything to be ready for the Antarctic conditions. Did a 2-minute story that Alaska has connection to salmon and to rivers and the outdoors. Our challenge now with having our changing climate, that our life is going to be changing up here, that our winters are changing, our skiing is changing, our gardening is changing. All those things are really impacting the way we think about our year ahead. Yet we are also a huge producer of oil and gas. And how do we find a way for those two things to not be in conflict, or can they be? So trying to explore those questions. And so my work really gets at the salmon piece of that story. How is climate affecting salmon? And what does salmon mean to Alaskans? And so it was a very easy video to produce. And of course, we had the moose in the background. That process was really fast. And so I found out by March that I had been accepted as one of the women on the second team. And we had 18 different countries represented in that second team. It does cost money. This Homeward Bound program was the vision that Fabian Dattner in Australia had about the way to move forward in the work that she does doing leadership training. She and this leadership team she's developed are all volunteering their time. And so as a participant in the program, I needed to be able to pay for the Antarctic expedition piece of it.
No one owns Antarctica.
Correct. Yeah.
But how does the Homeward Bound program connect to, like, which base did you go to?
You're right. The Antarctic Treaty, which was signed by 22 signatory countries in 1951 with a goal of science and peace. Those countries have bases down there and are doing research through things like the National Science Foundation. We actually went to 4 of the bases when we were there, an Argentinian, a Chinese, a American, and a British base. We actually were not there to do research. So we were actually on a ship that is licensed as a tourist ship, and we would get off every day and get to walk among the penguins, and thrilled as every other tourist who gets to go down there. We did have, I think, some deeper conversations with the scientists at the different stations, but the work that we were doing was the leadership training. The scientists on board were doctors and veterinarians and people who study brains, and there were some ecologists like myself, but it was a really wide net of scientists. And so we weren't there to be doing oceanographic research or penguin research or anything like that. We were there to have that landscape help inform the conversations that we had about how the landscape is changing, and also as a headspace for us to be removed from our daily lives, away from our cell phones, able to engage with each other in a way that kept the challenges and chores at bay, and that we could really envision what we wanted the future to look like without being sort of hamstrung by reality.
I do want to go back to how you were funded, but I can't help but go ahead and ask right now, what could a trip to Antarctica inform your work here?
So Antarctica, just like the Arctic, those two polar regions are changing faster than the rest of the world.
Closer you are to the poles, the more you notice this.
Yeah, and Antarctica is fascinating because it is a huge landmass covered in ice.
For now,
and I'll talk about that. And the Arctic is actually not a landmass, right? It's just this big open sea. And so when we think about the ice in the Arctic, it's actually sea ice. And so the melting of the Arctic ice cap is not actually influencing sea level rise, whereas in Antarctica, because all of that ice is sitting on top of land, as it melts, it is actually adding water to our oceans. And 90% of the world's ocean is tied up in Antarctica. 70% of the fresh water in the world is tied up in Antarctica. And it's 10% of the land mass. So it is a huge contributor to our water cycle and also the circulation of ocean waters.
Right. So what my understanding is, and oh, help me understand this better, that the Gulf Stream patterns will change.
Yeah. Yep.
In coming years.
Yeah.
And not 100 years from now, but they're seeing evidence of it already.
Yep. So Antarctica, we left from Ushuaia, Argentina, and we went 40 hours due south across the Drake Passage.
How big is this boat?
It's a 280 feet boat. So it's a good size. It's an old NOAA ship, actually. It was an old expedition ship for NOAA down there. And so it's not a fancy ship, very utilitarian, but super comfortable. It was a great ride. And we were very fortunate. We did not have there's some wild stories of getting across the Drake Passage. It is a huge body of water because it actually has a circulation pattern that goes all the way around the world without being broken by a landmass. So talk about fetch. It goes all the way around and that water down there is circulating without hitting Africa, Australia, South America.
So that's why rounding the tip of South America is so difficult, because no landmass ever breaks the flow of that water.
No, and you're getting that's where it's pinched. So Cape Horn and then the top end of the Antarctic Peninsula is the narrowest region of that big Southern Ocean circulation system. So that's where it gets really crazy. And as you add fresh water into that, so the melting that's happening from the Antarctic Peninsula actually changes those circulation patterns. There's upwelling and changes in productivity and changes in wind. So there's a lot of really fascinating oceanographic and atmospheric dynamics going on down there that will have real implications for our oceans. It'll change the circulation patterns within those oceans. So changes in jet stream up in the Atlantic, it's hard to imagine that it could be influenced by things going down in Antarctica, but it is. And that's part of our challenge with these global atmospheric issues, is it's actually all really connected. And so trying to understand the implications of the changing wind patterns in the Arctic or Antarctic and what that means for other places in the world, it's just fascinating. This program that I was on was actually a full year. I did spend those 3 weeks on that ship in Antarctica, but it was also a whole year previously where the women from our team would get together digitally. We would get together on a call where we were all, and we had to do video calls. We couldn't just do phone. We had to all be ready to be on video, and that we could see each other's faces from places all over the world. Our biggest challenge is that we weren't all awake at the same time, and so we'd have to have two sessions because we were dealing with time zones. But we were getting to see each other and get to know each other for a full year before we actually met each other, which was a really fascinating. By the time we actually were in the same space, it was like you had 78 new best friends that you had been getting to know for a year and you finally got to meet them. So it was a really fascinating to do it at this time in history when we have that kind of global connection, digital connection to each other.
So that's Sue Mauger from Cook Inlet Keeper. That's the beginning of her interview of her trip to Antarctica. I think she sets it up pretty well.
As always, thanks to the Kachemak Bay Birders for sharing bird rhythms and the bird of the month with Kachemak Science. Also, thanks to Hudson Lowboy and Bubba Shewitt Iwamura from McNeil Canyon Elementary School for presenting their data on dissolved oxygen and macroinvertebrates. And thanks to Phil Barber, local scientist, for helping to guide the discussion following that presentation. Thanks to Homer City Planner Julie Engelbretson for her talk on the Bridge Creek watershed taken from the Kachemak Science Conference last month. Special thanks to Rachel Lord and Kyra Wagner for being a part of Kachemak Science today to assist us in our membership drive. Next month on Kachemak Science, you'll hear part two of Sue Mauger talking about her trip to Antarctica. And we'll be hearing from scientists from the Center for Alaskan Coastal Studies on the topic of sea star wasting. This has been the Spring Fun Drive edition of Kachemak Science. If you are of a mind to support a show about local science here in Homer, go to kbbi.org and become a member of this radio station. Or don't become a member, just throw us a little cash and support local programming for scientists on the Kenai Peninsula. Thanks for listening. The next episode of Kachemak Science will air on May 26th, right here on your public radio station. KBBI, AM 890, Homer. Or live stream us at kbbi.org. Take it away, Wales.